the CBS News Weekend Roundup in 60 seconds.
I'm Lex Friedman. I run my own business, so I know from experience, hiring new employees can be tough. Posting your job in one place isn't enough to find quality candidates. If you want to find the perfect hire, you need to post your job on all the top job sites. And now you can. With ZipRecruiter.com, you can post your job to 50-plus job sites, including social networks like Facebook and Twitter, all with a single click. Find candidates in any industry nationwide. Just post once and watch your qualified candidates roll in to ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use interface. And with ZipRecruiter's premium traffic boost, you can get up to 3 times more candidates. Quickly screen applicants, rate them, and hire the right person fast. Find out why ZipRecruiter has been used by over 200,000 businesses. Right now, our listeners can try ZipRecruiter for free. Plus, get 30% off your first traffic boost by going to ZipRecruiter.com/deal. That's ZipRecruiter.com/deal. One more time. To try it for free, go to ZipRecruiter.com/deal.
This is the CBS News Weekend Roundup, a wrap-up of the week with background and analysis from the correspondents who cover the news. And now from Washington, here's CBS News national correspondent Dan Rabin.
Shock after shock after shock when it comes to the crash of a German passenger plane into a mountain in France. First, that it happened. All 150 people on board were killed. Second, the revelation that the co-pilot did it intentionally, locking the pilot out of the cockpit. And third, that the co-pilot had a medical condition. A doctor suggested he was unfit for work, and that probably is the start of understanding his motive. We'll have coverage and analysis coming up. Later, CBS's David Martin on a court-martial plan for Bo Bergdahl, the army man released by the Taliban after 5 years as part of a prisoner swap. Bergdahl now charged with deserting from his base in Afghanistan to avoid hazardous duties.
The second more serious charge of misbehavior before the enemy accuses Bergdahl, who reportedly walked off the base after his guard shift, of endangering his unit.
You'll also hear a CBS News political analyst, Anthony Salvanto, on the emerging field of Republicans running for president. Ted Cruz formally declared. And will there be any Democrat running against Hillary Clinton?
People always like choice, but her popularity is going to be very daunting to a lot of prospective challengers. She's very, very popular among Democrats.
Also, Saudi Arabia starts bombing in Yemen, apparently to push back Iran's influence. Those stories and a lot more on this weekend roundup. But first, the crash of an Airbus belonging to a budget airline called German Wings, flying from Barcelona, Spain, headed for Dusseldorf. Over French territory, the plane descended gradually with no distress call or sudden movement as seen on radar, and it crashed into the Alps. Rescue and salvage workers say not a single body was intact. 150 people were killed, including 2 babies. The victims included 3 U.S. citizens. The crash occurred on Tuesday. On Thursday night, before we learned about the co-pilot's undisclosed illness and his torn-up sick note, CBS News correspondent Mark Phillips in a French town near the crash site was able to report.
It wasn't an accident. The French prosecutor says it was murder. For the first 20 minutes of the flight, the cockpit conversation is technical and normal. Then, with the plane at its cruising altitude of 38,000 feet, the pilot is heard to hand over control to his co-pilot and leaves the cockpit, presumably for a bathroom break. The co-pilot then, alone in the cockpit, inexplicably sets the plane's autopilot to begin a steady, deliberate descent. Data from an aviation flight tracking service shows the altitude setting was turned down to 100 feet, its lowest possible level. And French prosecutor Brice Robin said setting the plane onto its fatal gradual dive was a deliberate act.
C'est alors qu'il est seul.
When he is alone in charge of this plane, he uses the flight monitoring system, which starts the descent of the aeroplane.
The pilot, now locked out of the cockpit, knocks on the door to try to get back in. The co-pilot doesn't respond. Getting increasingly desperate, the pilot knocks harder, calls on the intercom, tries to force his way in. The co-pilot keeps the door locked, and as the plane descends, he doesn't respond to radio calls from air traffic control or from other planes in the area.
The victims only realize at the last moment, because on the recording you only hear the screams literally on the last moments of the recording.
In Germany, the airline's owners could only express shock and remorse themselves. This wasn't suicide, Lufthansa's CEO Carsten Spohr said. When a man is responsible for ending 150 lives, there has to be another word.
As Mark Phillips reported from France, it was murder. Now, what was discovered on Friday? CBS's Alan Pizzi in Montabaur, Germany, the hometown of the co-pilot Andreas Lubitz.
Investigators who searched the homes that were used by Andreas Lubitz said they found evidence that he had concealed a medical condition from his employers. They found torn-up medical notes indicating he was having some kind of treatment, though they don't say for what. One of those notes apparently had a date that coincided with the date of the fatal flight. Now, what illness he was hiding, we don't know, but his employer's German wing said that they, as far as they were concerned, he was certified 100% fit to fly, both medically and training-wise. It is known, however, that sometime in 2009, he took a six-month break from training, and some friends who were quoted by local media here said that he was suffering at that point from depression. But he otherwise appeared to be quite a normal young man. He really enjoyed flying. He learned to do it at a gliding school. He was often seen here in the town of where his parents lived, jogging, had a lot of friends, but was a quiet young man. There was no indication on the surface that this was a troubled young man, but the prosecutors did find medical evidence in his home to suggest that he was suffering from some kind of illness. Whether that was mental or physical is not known at this point, but it does shed a new light on the problems. And they also said, however, it should be noted that there was no evidence of any religious or political motivation.
Alan Pizzi reporting from Germany on Friday. Here through an interpreter is a prosecutor in Düsseldorf, Christoph Kumpa, on the search through Andreas Lubitz's belongings.
Medical documents were seized which point to an existing illness and medical treatment. The fact that torn-up current sick notes were found seemed to support the assumption that he had kept his illness from his employer and his colleagues.
I'm Vicky Barker at Düsseldorf Airport.
It's unbelievable. Absolutely unbelievable.
Germans are struggling to come to terms with the contents of that cockpit voice recorder.
That a guy who wants to murder himself has 149 other people in his plane and crashes into the Alps. That's really tragic.
One woman says how difficult it must be for the parents knowing one man's deliberate action took their children away from them.
And in Haltern, Germany, where 16 high school students and two of their teachers were expected home on Tuesday after an exchange visit in Spain, their sudden deaths hit hard. CBS News correspondent Holly Williams reports grief counselors tried to help students and teachers at the school on Wednesday.
They were flying home from a class trip to Spain to visit Spanish students who'd traveled to Haltern last year.
They were just excited to see them again, to go to Spain and just have a good time, and now they won't come back.
Adina Halbom counted several of the teenagers who lost their lives as her friends.
I still feel like they're going to come here again and just tell us what the trip was like and tell us about their future plans. I just can't believe it.
In this rural community of just 35,000, nearly everyone knew someone who was on board the plane. The school's vice principal, Suzanne Baldauf, is grieving for her two colleagues and 16 young people she'd watched grow up.
Everybody, yeah, is in disbelief and in kind of state of shock, the whole town, really.
CBS's Holly Williams in Germany. We'll have more on air travel and keeping an eye on the health of pilots and crew, and a lot more news coming up.
Stay with us on the CBS News Weekend Roundup. This is the CBS News Weekend Roundup. Once again, here's correspondent Dan Revie.
The revelation that the co-pilot of that German airliner that crashed, killing 150 people, did it intentionally raises questions in the minds of a lot of travelers. Take a bus, a train, you're putting your life in the hands of the driver. When we fly, we trust that the pilots are sane, sober, and reliable. One 27-year-old co-pilot locked out the senior pilot and set the navigation system to go down into a French mountain? That's what authorities are saying.
It's absolutely mind-boggling, shocking, and extremely disappointing.
That's a former chairman of the National Transportation Safety Board, CBS News analyst Mark Rosenker.
They will be going through this man's background with a fine-tooth comb. this is the focus of the investigation right now. We're never going to be able to get into the mind of this individual, but they will be looking very carefully to try to understand the motivation here.
After authorities in Germany announced that Andreas Lubitz, the co-pilot, had some medical problem and was reportedly declared unfit for work, but the airline did not know that, CBS News transportation correspondent Jeff Pegay has reported a sad irony that post-9/11 security improvements made the cockpit impossible to get into.
On airlines in the United States, the cockpit door is reinforced with bulletproof material, and a series of locks keep the pilot sealed off from the cabin and crew. When a pilot exits the cockpit, a flight attendant or relief pilot must go in and lock the door so that there are two people in the cockpit at all times.
There's no 100% guarantees in the aviation security business. And
former TSA administrator John Pistol says there are trade-offs to the security measures.
It's designed to keep bad guys from outside the cockpit from getting in. It's not designed to keep people with bad intent in the cockpit from doing something bad.
According to the Aviation Safety Network, worldwide there have been at least 9 pilot suicides since 1976. All 217 passengers and crew died when Egypt Air Flight 990 crashed off the coast of Nantucket in 1999. U.S. investigators believe the co-pilot was to blame. Before they are hired, U.S. commercial pilots are screened and evaluated. On the job, they undergo medical exams every 6 months for pilots 40 or older, and every year for those who are younger. International aviation officials have expressed concerns about whether medical exams go far enough for younger pilots. In a 2012 document, the International Civil Aviation Organization said that an increased emphasis on mental health may be warranted.
CBS's Jeff Pegues. After this crash into the French Alps, European and other airlines announced that they, too, will now require that at least 2 crew members be in the cockpit at all times. Now, other news. The military is bringing charges against Bo Bergdahl, the army sergeant who was held by the Taliban in Afghanistan for 5 years, then released 10 months ago in a controversial prisoner exchange. Here's CBS News correspondent David Martin.
The first charge, desertion, accuses Bergdahl of quitting his duty station, a patrol base in Afghanistan, with the intent to shirk hazardous duty. The second, more serious charge of misbehavior before the enemy, accuses Bergdahl, who reportedly walked off the base after his guard shift, of endangering his unit. Bergdahl already has spent 5 years in captivity at the hands of the Haqqani network in Pakistan, an ordeal that ended in May 2014 when he was released in exchange for 5 senior Taliban operatives held at Guantanamo. Critics have argued the U.S. gave up too much for Bergdahl, but it was a price President Obama was willing to pay as part of ending the war in Afghanistan. He brought home the only missing soldier from that war.
He wasn't forgotten by his country.
At that same appearance, the president introduced Bergdahl's father, who riled some viewers by speaking in the language of the enemy.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Bergdahl, who has been assigned to a desk at Fort Sam Houston, Texas, since his return to the U.S., will now face the military equivalent of a grand jury to determine whether there is enough evidence to merit a court-martial.
A defense attorney for Bergdahl says he claims he left his post in order to find a commanding officer and have a private chat about discipline problems in their unit. But then Bergdahl was captured by the Taliban. Another report by David Martin at the Pentagon, a National Guard soldier charged with an Islamist-inspired mass murder plot.
Hassan Edmonds, a member of the Illinois National Guard, and his cousin Jonas were apparently planning a massacre. According to court documents, Hassan would provide Jonas with military uniforms and a layout of his National Guard base in Joliet, Illinois. And Jonas and one other man would storm it with AK-47s and grenades. They anticipated a body count of 100 to 150. But the other man turned out to be an undercover informant. The cousins went before a federal judge in Chicago, facing 15 years in prison on charges of supporting ISIS. The investigation began when the informant friended Hassan on Facebook. Hassan and Jonas wanted to join ISIS, taking the southern route to Syria through Egypt. If they couldn't do that, Hassan told the informant, I am content to fight and die here. Honestly, we would love to do something like the brothers in Paris did, an apparent reference to January's attacks, which left 12 dead. The plot advanced to the point of casing the National Guard base in Joliet, but then Hassan got his passport and a plane ticket to Cairo. Jonas, who couldn't get a passport because he had a criminal record, would stay behind and carry out the attack.
CBS's David Martin, prosecutors remind us that everyone is innocent until proved guilty under law. Also at the Pentagon, CBS News correspondent Cammie McCormick has been monitoring the multinational coalition that Saudi Arabia organized with at least nine other Arab and Muslim countries bombing the rebels in neighboring Yemen who are known to be supported by Iran.
The U.S. says it understands Saudi Arabia's border concerns.
We're supportive of the actions by the Saudis and their coalition partners.
And the State Department's Jeff Rathke says Yemen briefly came up during the nuclear talks in Switzerland between Secretary of State Kerry and his Iranian counterpart. Rathke says the U.S. wants a diplomatic solution.
We're not taking sides against Shia, a Shia faction against the Sunni faction. We're trying to promote a dialogue process.
Yemen was a key U.S. ally in counterterrorism.
In fact, just around the time that Yemen's President Hadi was fleeing, 150 U.S. military personnel left Yemen. Their mission was to focus on attacking al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. Scott Pelley spoke about that with the former number two at the CIA, Michael Morell, now a CBS News analyst.
Michael, why did the U.S. pull their forces out?
Scott, when the political crisis started in Yemen a couple months ago, we said that that would divert the attention of the Yemeni military, the Yemeni government from al-Qaeda, and al-Qaeda would benefit. And that's exactly what's happened. Al-Qaeda in Yemen has gained ground in the last few weeks, very, very close to where these special forces were operating, and that forced the United States to pull them out.
Does the withdrawal of the special forces mean the U.S. is blind in Yemen?
Scott, they were doing two things there. They were training the Yemeni military, and they were collecting intelligence. So with the evacuation of the embassy and now the evacuation of these special forces, our intelligence on AQAP, on al-Qaeda in Yemen, is going to go down.
Up next, who's running for president and will any Democrat oppose Hillary Clinton?
Stay with us on the CBS News Weekend Roundup.
Contracts that never end.
Infuriating customer service.
Rate plans that make your head explode. The old rules of wireless have never really worked, especially for business. T-Mobile has sent those rules to the shredder. Our Simple Choice plan delivers clear, straightforward rates. No haggling and no begging required. Now, our best price is the only price. And we'll lock in your rates without locking you into a contract. It's the uncontract. We make the guarantees, and you keep all the freedom. And your T-Mobile business account comes with 24/7 support from a dedicated business account team at no extra charge, officially putting an end to DIY wireless. T-Mobile is changing the way business does wireless. Switch today at T-Mobile.com/business.
Qualifying service but no long-term contract required. Rate lock applies to the Simple Choice plan. Unlimited high-speed data pricing good for at least 2 years. High-speed data allotments price locked at speeds available at time of activation up to 42 megabits per second. See a T-Mobile store for offer details.
This is the CBS News Weekend Roundup. Once again, here's Dan Revie.
There are now two Republicans who have officially declared they're running for president. Dr. Ben Carson did so 4 months ago. And now the first elected politician to do so, Ted Cruz, senator from Texas. Cruz made his announcement at Liberty University in Virginia, a college known for strong evangelical Christian beliefs, where he asked his audience to imagine America being led by a man who would abolish the IRS, uphold traditional marriage, create more jobs for young people, and unabashedly support Israel.
Imagine abolishing. Imagine a federal government. Imagine a president who...
Cruz also said right away if he becomes president in January of 2017, he'll sign a law abolishing Obamacare. But he does need coverage, as CBS News congressional correspondent Steve Portnoy reported.
With his wife taking a leave of absence from Goldman Sachs, Ted Cruz says he'll now get insurance from his job. And in Congress, that's a plan on the exchanges Cruz has fought so hard to abolish. Cruz explained his decision on CNN.
Listen, it was the case before Obamacare that federal employees could get health insurance through their jobs. That's not a new development. So yes, I'll get my insurance through my job like millions of other Americans.
But Cruz says he won't accept the employer contribution that would have the government paying for most of his policy. Stephen Portnoy, CBS News, Capitol Hill.
So if you think about the Republican field, as we've reported before here on the Weekend Roundup, it looks like it's going to be a big field. Who's hot and who's not? Let's put that question to Anthony Salvanto, who's a director of election coverage and analysis here at CBS News. Cruz is in. Others are probably going to announce soon that they are formally entering the race. From what you can tell, including polling results, who's hot among the Republicans?
You know, Dan, the most important word you said there is big. It is going to be a big field. There's no question about it. Yes, Senator Cruz is in early. There's a lot of good reasons why someone might want to get in early. You want to get that base activated. You want to get people out there who will campaign for you, who might raise money for you. And certainly with the amount of money that this campaign will probably cost, well, there's maybe no time to be lost. I do suspect, though, that we're going to see a number of other candidates formally jump in the coming weeks.
And one of them would be a conservative in his state, Rick Perry, having been governor of Texas. He's run before. I'm thinking of a similar situation in Florida where Jeb Bush, well, it's assumed that that former governor will run for president. And Marco Rubio, the senator from Florida, he apparently wants to run. I'm just thinking there'd be a lot of competition there for the same campaign donors.
Yes, there very well may be. And we could add to that list other presumptive candidates. Scott Walker of Wisconsin got a lot of positive buzz out of a couple of speeches that he made recently to conservative audiences. So he's been mentioned. Of course, New Jersey Governor Chris Christie has been in the conversation. Not sure whether or not he will join in. So, yes, it's a big field, but this is what's important about that from a numbers standpoint. You don't need to win everybody when it's a big field. You need to win a small amount, but just be better than the other guys.
Is it important also to be different and distinctive? Some people feel that Senator Rand Paul is, a bit different, very clearly a Tea Party kind of guy, or at least he used to be.
The Tea Party is interesting because in 2014, they challenged a lot of standing Republicans in a lot of Senate primaries, and they came up short. In 2012, a lot of folks argued that they certainly moved the party towards their views, but didn't have a candidate directly of their own. And this could be a year where maybe they get one, or at least are more in the conversation. I think that the Tea Party, which with 4 in 10 Republicans, give or take, identify themselves as Tea Party supporters, that's a critical group. Evangelical Christians, conservatives, are also a critical group. There's a lot of parts of that base. And if somebody gets 20-25% consistently once we head towards the fall, they're a contender.
And you did mention the fall. When should we really start paying attention and realize, someone really is a front runner in the Republican field?
If you're a political junkie, you can start paying attention right now
all
of this is starting to build. However, you wouldn't pay attention to the horse race polls until the fall. You would pay attention, though, right, to fundraising, to where people are going, how many visits to places like Iowa and New Hampshire. That's already starting up because they have to organize.
And Anthony, once a candidate declares that he or she is actually in the race, is there more of a burden to disclose where the money is coming from?
There can be, and it really depends on how the campaign sets up its fundraising, whether they set up a PAC, how they set up the campaign organization. For most folks, we see in the polls that they look at this process and they say, well, there's an awful lot of money in politics. And where is it going? And who is giving it? And some people say, well, that's free speech and let them make their arguments. And we all know that some folks who've spent an awful lot of money have not won. On the other hand, disclosure and whether or not people can trace who's giving them money sometimes becomes as much a part of learning about a candidate as what they're saying if we're able to do it.
But one example of undisclosed spending would be through some outside organization, say a PAC, a political action committee, that might buy a lot of advertising that could well help candidate X. But as long as there's no connection with candidate X and the official campaign, there's apparently no limit on spending.
What happens is you see advertisements, and folks will be familiar with these, where they say, call your congressman or, tell so-and-so that this isn't right. And they're advocating an issue side, which might be something very close to what their preferred candidate, where they stand, but it's not directly saying vote for candidate X. And that's the difference. But does the message get across? Well, there's a lot of evidence that it does help. But having said that, you get to also see a lot of big spending campaigns where that message doesn't get across because the other side may be spending just as much.
Anthony, let's shift focus to the Democrats, or maybe I should say the Democrat, who's likely to run for president. Some Democrats are complaining quietly. Only one candidate, only Hillary Rodham Clinton. There's a CBS News poll indicating that her popularity might have gone down a little bit because of her use of her private email system.
Most of them said it didn't change their opinion of Clinton. Part of that is that they already had a long-standing one. Of course, she's been a public figure for many years.
Oh, they might have liked her or not, but the email incident didn't affect them.
Right. However, there was a portion, about 29%, as I recall, who said that the email incident made them think worse of her. Going forward, you're going to see, I think, a lot of discussion around Secretary of State Clinton and her campaign and whether or not she will be challenged by anyone in the Democratic Party. And that's certainly something to watch on that side. You know, a lot of people consider her to be the presumptive nominee already. But I think you will hear a lot of Democrats say, well, will there be a discussion? People always like choice. But her popularity, though, is going to be very daunting to a lot of prospective challengers. She's very, very popular among Democrats.
Anthony Salvanto, who analyzes and understands elections here at CBS News. Thank you, Anthony.
Thank you, Dan.
Please follow us on Twitter for the latest headlines at CBS Radio News. And I'm at Dan Revive.
This is the CBS News Weekend Roundup, a wrap-up of the week with the correspondents who cover the news. This is the CBS News Weekend Roundup. Once again, here's Dan Revie.
Heading into this weekend, it looked like make or break for the Iran nuclear talks. This coming Tuesday, the end of March, was set long ago as a target date. Some call it a deadline for a framework agreement between Iran on one side and the P5 plus one, six countries, including the United States. In the past few days, Iran's President Rouhani sent a letter to President Obama, and Rouhani had phone conversations with the leaders of Britain, France, and other nations in the P5 plus one. Here's CBS News correspondent Margaret Brennan covering the talks in Switzerland this past Thursday.
Secretary Kerry is meeting with Iran's negotiators, and if these talks go well, U.S. diplomats are very optimistic that they could close a deal by Tuesday that would curb Iran's ability to build a nuclear weapon. In exchange, Iran would get billions of dollars in sanctions relief. Now, Kerry has assailed the many critics of this emerging deal, saying they have offered no viable alternative. We asked one of those critics, fellow Democrat Bob Menendez, to respond.
Both the president and the secretary have not offered any alternatives to a deal either, which makes me concerned that their only view is that a deal has to be had. And if you let the other side know that you are committed to a deal at any cost, then the deal you're going to get may not be very good.
Now, Menendez and some Republicans have prepared a new round of sanctions on Iran if these talks fail. And if they succeed, it's up to Kerry and the administration to convince Congress not to torpedo this emerging deal.
That's our State Department correspondent Margaret Brennan covering the nuclear negotiations in Switzerland. CBS's Charlie Rose took another trip to the capital of Syria, Damascus, where he was granted an interview with President Bashar al-Assad, their second face-to-face conversation since the start of the Syrian civil war more than 4 years ago. Despite more than 220,000 deaths and parts of his country held by ISIS and other rebels, some of them backed by the U.S., President Assad acts as though things are manageable. He does express interest in negotiations, including dialogue with the United States.
Any dialogue is positive, as I said, in principle, of course.
In the interview for this Sunday's 60 Minutes, Charlie Rose asked if it's true that poison chlorine gas has been used by Syria's army against rebel fighters and civilians. Assad, who pronounces chlorine as chlorine, denies it.
This is part of the malicious propaganda against Syria. First of all, the chlorine gas is not military gas. You can buy it anywhere.
And it's, but it can be weaponized.
No, because it's not very effective. It's not used as military gas.
But Assad also denied what's quite obvious from video during the civil war, that his army's helicopters drop barrel bombs on civilian neighborhoods. Now back in this country, an apology at the University of Oklahoma from one of the students who was expelled after his fraternity was seen on a cell phone video singing and chanting racist songs and slogans. CBS's Manuel Bajorquez reports.
20-year-old Levi Pettit said he will stand up against racism.
Let me start by saying that I'm sorry, deeply sorry. I'm so sorry for all the pain that I've caused, and I want you all to know that directly from me. Although I don't deserve it, I want to ask for your forgiveness.
Was it that you just didn't understand how bad those words were, or simply chose to ignore that?
I knew they were wrong. I never knew how or why they were wrong.
Before the apology, he spent the afternoon at an Oklahoma City church speaking with clergy and community leaders, a meeting arranged by Oklahoma State Senator Anastasia Pittman.
Because we know the state of Oklahoma has some issues that we need to talk about, and this is just the beginning of a great conversation.
Now let's talk about food. You've heard that whole grain, bread, and cereal are healthy choices. New evidence reported by CBS News correspondent Barry Bagnato.
Whole grain foods and cereal fibers, they extend your life, Harvard researchers report in a large study tracking more than 367,000 middle-aged and older Americans. Consuming just over an ounce of whole grains daily reduces the risk of premature death 17%. Positive impacts were noted against a variety of major illnesses, including cancer, heart disease, respiratory disorders, and diabetes. Similar benefits were found in people who ate small amounts of cereal fibers. Not hard to accomplish, says Quinnipiac University nutritionist Dana White.
Putting some granola on a yogurt, making sure that when you choose sandwiches or even pasta dishes that you go for the whole grain versions.
This study in the journal BMC Medicine. Barry Bagnato, CBS News, Washington.
Now food addictions. We turn to Dr. Vera Tarman, based in Toronto. You have an organization and a website called Addictions Unplugged. And Dr. Tarman, a new book titled Food Junkies. On the cover, some donuts. Is this really sugar addiction? You call it food addiction.
Sugar is universally probably the thing that most people are addicted to. But I want to say that the brain is already wired. You don't have to be a food addict to like sugar. The brain's wired to like energy-dense foods, so anything that's sugary or fatty. But you see, the food industry has actually engineered foods to include sugar, fat, salt, to make them extremely addictive. But that doesn't mean that you're a food addict. A food addict is when the obsession around food, basically life revolves around their eating.
Do you have any estimate as to what percentage of the North American population would qualify as food addicts?
With the research that has actually been compiled, we would say that probably between 5 and 10% of the normal population are food addicts. And just to put that into context, 10% are alcoholics and about 5% are drug addicts. So it fits within the range of general addiction. But if you look at specific populations like the overweight or the obese population, then we're looking at actually 30 to 40% of that population. Pointing out, though, then that that's at least 70 or 60% that aren't food addicts. So you don't have to be obese or thin or normal weight to be a food addict. It can be actually unrelated.
Some people are thin and are food addicts. So even your book, Food Junkies, you're not proposing a diet so I lose weight.
No, absolutely not. This is actually more about the addictive piece itself and the obsession of the mind, because the person may not actually need to be on a diet because they're already binging and purging or something like that. It's more about the obsessional piece in the mind, and then the weight is just a byproduct.
So trying to reduce or eliminate the obsession, can you describe some possible therapies?
The main thing, and this is where it's different than somebody who's a binge eater or an anorexic or a bulimic, the main thing is to not try to go on a diet and control your calories and, you know, have just a little bit of sweets on the weekend or, you know, basically moderate your diet. That's not the plan. The plan is identify, and you can use any plan at all because it's individual. What are your trigger foods, which is probably sugar, and it might be nuts or dairy or something else, but maybe not for somebody else. Identify the trigger food and then stop that food with support because it's really hard to stop.
Don't have it around the house and tell our friends and loved ones not to have it around.
You got it exactly. And avoid buffets, avoid places like parties, especially in new recovery. And when you do go to those places, get lots of support. Tell friends, look, when we're at the buffet, you get it for me so that I'm not tempted.
The book is titled Food Junkies. That's the author, Dr. Vera Tarman. Thank you very much, Dr. Tarman.
Thank you for asking me to speak.
Up next, the House and Senate passed the Republican version of a federal budget, but that does not resolve the issue. Then questions about fundraising by the Clintons.
Stay with us on the CBS News Weekend Roundup.
With CudaSign, paperless e-signing is a no-brainer for any business that requires legally binding signatures fast. That's because CudaSign offers everything you should expect from an electronic signature solution for just $1 per month. CudaSign cuts document turnaround time as much as 90%, thanks in part to its number one rated mobile app. And CudaSign's secure cloud stores documents for on-demand tracking and retrieval, saving you even more time and money. Don't think twice. Get CudaSign now for just $1 per month. Go to CudaSign.com.
This is the CBS News Weekend Roundup. Once again, here's Dan Revie.
How to finance the federal government, a major dispute between the Republicans who hold the majority in both houses of Congress and President Obama. He, on Thursday, went to Birmingham, Alabama, mostly to talk about the economy. CBS News White House correspondent Pam Coulter.
On a visit to Lawson State Community College, the president took aim at the House-passed budget, which he said includes tax cuts for the wealthiest Americans while cutting investment in education and doubling the number of people without health insurance. He said it would also weaken consumer protections.
If Republicans in Congress send me a bill that unravels the reforms we've put in place, if they send me a bill that unravels Wall Street reform, I will veto it.
He says the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau has recovered $5 billion for 15 million families. Pam Coulter, CBS News, The White House.
Now a CBS News investigation into some of the millions of dollars raised by the Clinton Foundation. Former President Bill Clinton, his wife Hillary, who's widely expected to run for the White House, and their daughter Chelsea all work for the foundation and raise money for good causes, they say, such as fighting disease and poverty around the world. But do some donors think they're buying influence? Here's CBS News correspondent Juliana Goldman.
Campaign finance laws prohibit foreign interests from investing in U.S. elections. It's a way of preventing foreigners from buying political influence here at home. But those rules don't apply to the Clinton Foundation, the nonprofit that bears the name of a likely presidential candidate.
I am very proud of the work the foundation does. I'm very proud of the hundreds of thousands of people who support the work of the foundation.
Since its founding, the Clinton Foundation has raised at least $42 million from foreign governments. And according to an analysis by CBS News, at least $170 million from foreign organizations, companies, and individuals. One donor, Relin Enterprises, pledged $2 million in 2013. The company is a privately held Chinese construction and trade conglomerate that's run by billionaire Wang Wenlang, who's a delegate to the Chinese parliament. Public records show the firm has spent $1.4 million since 2012 lobbying Congress and the State Department. The firm owns a strategic port along the border with North Korea and was also one of the contractors that built the Chinese embassy in Washington. Jim Mann has written several books on China's relationship with the U.S.
Embassy construction, one of the most important tasks is making sure that there are no bugs there. So you want to have the closest security and intelligence connections with and approval of the person or company that's going to build your embassy.
Thank you all and good morning.
The Clinton Foundation largely stopped taking money from foreign governments when Hillary Clinton became Secretary of State in 2009. It resumed the practice once she left in 2013, but never stopped taking money from foreign companies or individuals. The foundation says that if Hillary Clinton runs for president, it will ensure the foundation's policies on international donors are appropriate, just as they did when she served as Secretary of State. Asked about donations from foreign governments, Hillary Clinton defended the foundation's work.
I think that people who want to support the foundation know full well what it is we stand for and what we're working on.
But Bill Allison of the Sunlight Foundation, a campaign finance watchdog group, says the Clinton Foundation is a unique nonprofit that can't be separated from the U.S. political system.
If there's foreign money coming into the Clinton Foundation, it will raise the question of, is the president going to be doing favors for a foreign business, a foreign government, for an individual, and you just cannot have that in the American system of government.
Clinton Foundation officials note that many major institutions have been under investigation, but that shouldn't stop them from giving to charity. A big issue here is when Hillary Clinton was at the State Department, the foundation could rely on the Obama administration to vet any foreign donations, but they don't have that mechanism built into a presidential campaign.
That from CBS News correspondent Juliana Goldman. Now, baseball's new season starts next weekend on Sunday night. The St. Louis Cardinals will visit the Chicago Cubs. The day after, Monday, April 6th, is opening day for all the other 28 teams. So spring training is winding down. And in Osceola County, Florida, just south of Orlando, there's a fear that spring training is moving away. Here's CBS News correspondent Peter King.
Number 39 catcher Jared Soltalamacchia.
Al Brasher loves Astros spring training games.
Here since 1985.
Dawn Goldston has come all the way from Texas for her first Astros spring training.
Loving it. Do it all over.
over again.
Yes, March is pretty special here in Central Florida.
It's my favorite month of the year.
But the Astros are leaving for South Florida after next spring for a shared facility with Washington Nationals, who train on the Space Coast just over an hour from here. With no close spring opponents, many fear the Atlanta Braves could leave the area when their lease expires at Disney World in 2017. You see, teams like to train near each other to avoid too many long bus trips. It's why so many are clustered in Tampa Bay, South Florida, and especially Arizona. Losing three teams would leave the Orlando area with no spring training for the first time since 1960. Osceola County Commission Chair Brandon Arrington hopes to save spring training here with two teams.
We've recently just been talking to the Braves. Some of their management was here at a game the other day, and we were trying to let them know that we're interested in making improvements to this facility to keep some teams here in Central Florida. The other team that has a possibility that we're trying to reach out to and get some discussions going are the Blue Jays.
Osceola County Stadium opened in 1985 with the Astros' first spring training here. Basically, it was rebuilt more than a decade ago. Arrington says it's got that old Florida charm with many of what today's fans want.
The biggest thing is the intimacy, how close you're able to get to the players. The contact is so unique.
Spring training, of course, is only part of the tourism mix here, and Arrington says while losing baseball wouldn't be catastrophic, it would hurt monetarily.
It's heads in beds, it's folks in restaurants.
And personally.
It's a fond memory I still have of my childhood, waiting for someone to hit a home run so I could tear out of my seat to run around the outside of the field to find that ball. I mean, those are memories you can't get them at a Major League Baseball game. You get them in spring training.
For the CBS News Weekend Roundup, I'm Peter King at Osceola County Stadium in Kissimmee, Florida.
Let's go to England. A widely hated king, Richard III, has gotten a very honorable royal reburial. CBS News reporter Larry Miller tells us about it.
We are not here to comment on whether he was a good king. It is where history meets the present. So went the eulogy at Leicester Cathedral for King Richard III, more than 500 years after being killed in battle. Richard's remains were discovered under a parking lot 3 years ago. Actor Benedict Cumberbatch, soon to portray Richard, recited a poem.
My skull, scarred by a crown, emptied of history.
Finally, Richard's coffin was lowered into a tomb fit for a king.
The Lord be with you.
Larry Miller, CBS News, London.
Thanks for being with us, and anytime you want to hear us, please do a web search for CBS Weekend Roundup. You'll find our podcasts also on iTunes and other podcast services, and our app for your smartphone is CBS Radio News. I'm Dan Revive. Bye.
You've been listening to the CBS News Weekend Roundup. The program is produced in the Washington Bureau of CBS News. The executive producer is Howard Arenstein.